This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 25th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design every week here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, I discuss the nipped and tucked design of the latest Italian special edition of Monocle with our art desk team.
Because you're doing Italy, don't go and stick a slice of pizza on the cover because you think that summarises Italy. You've got to still do what your readers kind of are wanting from you. You've got to do a Monocle cover first and then sort of theme it Italian.
And we talked to the winner of Canada's Emerging Designer Award, 26-year-old Lucas Pete.
For me, it needs to have something different, either on like a unexpected scale, unexpected material, color, function. If you have the opportunity to create something new, you should try to.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Let's begin with a tribute to the new edition of Monocle magazine, On Your Stands Now. It's an Italy special edition showcasing the people, the places and even the politicians that are ensuring the nation remains a world-class player. The issue also marks a slight redesign of the magazine, which is celebrating its 7th birthday. To discuss all of this, I am joined by Rich Spencer Powell, our creative director, and Poppy Shibamoto, our photo director. So, Rich, let's start with this redesign, which we've discussed before and it's been in hot anticipation.
First of all, I think one thing you need to know about the design of Monocle is that it's 7 years old, and over those 70 issues we have tweaked it, you know, very marginally as we go. So it's not like it's a redesign from issue one and now it's different. It's been changing ever so slightly, evolving, should we say, ever so slightly. So it's quite slight what we've done. It wasn't broken, so I don't think it needs to be fixing. But most of the change you'll see is in the news pages. Mm-hmm. And you will continue to see some sort of changes as we go forward, because we didn't want to put everything into one issue, so we'll sort of stage by stage add things in. But primarily, the news pages, the briefing pages have been tweaked, and the edit section's been tweaked. And what we've done is we've kind of introduced new shapes and colour. We've tweaked the grid. And that is invisible really to your eye, but what you get for that is that we've actually managed to fit more words on. So they're denser, there's more to read, which means more value for money. So that's primarily what we did.
To the listeners among us who aren't familiar with InDesign, what does that actually mean, sort of tweak the grid?
So to tweak the grid, I mean, this is
a very geek-sounding phrase, isn't it?
It is, but designers out there will be loving it. So the format of the magazine follows a set of grid lines. It's very structured, and it's a set. The type is set so that you can only have a set number of words on. We have condensed that ever so slightly, so you can then fit more words on. In other words, in layman's terms, we've made the point size smaller. Hence more words, hence there's more stories and more to read. So there's just a little bit more on the page.
Fantastic. And any other, I mean, are there any new typefaces? I'm knowing sort of the illustration looks...
We've introduced
slightly.
We introduce new illustrators as often as we can, just to keep it fresh. Well, I think one thing to note is that we've got a new fashion director, and although Akio Hasegawa has been working with us from issue one, he's now the fashion director, so he's on board as a full-time employee, and we've given him a bit of a carte blanche on some the next few fashion stories. And I think there's a great fashion story he's done. His first one, sort of working under this new title, it's just a great piece of styling. It's set in Tokyo because there's a huge Italian influence in tailoring in Japan. They just seem to understand the Italian brands almost better than the Italians do, and that's sort of saying something, seeing as Italy is renowned for its style. So I think that's a slightly fresh approach as well, just on a sort of photographic and fashion styling slant.
It's incredibly graphic. I mean, for the listeners, it's a series of almost full bleed images, portraits against a very kind of stark, we've got the guy against the sky and then a girl walking down the stairs. It's very sort of...
It's clean and sharp and quite up for this time of year, actually. I mean, it is sort of, we're getting into spring, summer clothing and it's just a really positive shoot, which is what you come to expect from Tokyo.
And going from Tokyo back to Italy, which is, of course, what this issue is all about. Poppy, let's talk about the challenges of when you're doing how many pages this is, 246 pages worth of content from One Nation. What are the challenges for you commissioning things like this when you've probably got quite a small pool of photographers, but you need to keep the issue looking quite varied inside?
Yeah, we find new photographers, obviously, in Italy as well. And, you know, we've done Portuguese-speaking issue, the German issue, UK issue. So, like, that's, like, a good point for us to focus on just One Nation and then just kind of really find the best talents there. But also keep going with the ones we already know, tested and proven great. So our usual photographer from Italy, they'll get a big features, and then also new ones get good portrait shoots. So it's really good when we have a focus on a country, like we can really focus on that to find illustrators as well, illustrators, photographers, you know, producers, all the new talents there. So that's really good.
Italy being probably one of the most photogenic of all the nations in the world. What are some of your favourite stories in the magazine? Obviously shooting it when we were in January wasn't ideal, but actually it's turned out to be quite a sort of upbeat, sunny issue.
Yeah, it's quite difficult always to do these winter issues, and it usually takes longer to shoot one story, or have to be careful with the timing of portrait shoots so that it's not nighttime or like after 4 o'clock and it's too dark. But I think the one story that didn't get shot in Italy, apart from fashion, is the story shot in Dubai, Cavour. Mm-hmm. That looks really nice. The photographer and writer went over New Year's holiday and they were like, okay, I'll drop everything for you, and then go to the shoot in New Year's Day in Dubai. So like, great, it looks really good, and that took a long time to shoot as well, so it really shows that as well, I think. But also portrait stories that Lowest Photo Editor commissioned, I think looks also very nice, for especially for winter issues. Mm-hmm. That looks warm and soft light, and yeah.
Rich, what about you? What are some of your favourite standout stories?
I think two from the back of the book. I think the Expo is very good. Sent a very good photographer to shoot Italian embassies. It's beautiful, and we've done a slight tweak on the layout as well. It feels a bit more like an art book. This amazing architecture, all shot by our architecture guy from Sweden, Orca. And then a tiny story, which is the My Last Meal, but it's one of those My Last Meals that I think really, really works. Just very, it looks very appetizing. The subject is very, very cool. It's Rosanna Orlandi. And just sometimes shoots just work out brilliantly. And when they do, when it's a My Last Meal, they always seem to catch my eye. I really like it. And in fact, one of the images from this story made the cover.
Exactly. Three of the design stories made the cover. I'd like to point out.
Well done, Tom.
It is Italy.
Talk about the cover, which when you do a sort of nation-focused issue like we've done here, what is the temptation to make it feel very Italian? Because there are hints of it, you kind of know what it's about, but it's not got an Italian flag pasted all over it. The German issue had a Haribo on the cover. How do you go about doing the obvious?
Well, I think first of all, you've got to remember it's a cover, and you've got to follow your own sort of cover rules. You've got to do what you feel is right. And that means don't break those rules. If it means, because you're doing Italy, don't go and stick a slice of pizza on the cover because you think that summarises Italy. You've got to still do what your readers kind of are wanting from you. So you've got to do a monocle cover first and then sort of theme it Italian. So I think, yeah, you don't go down the cliche route. And also I think our approach on doing surveys on entire nations is that you want to surprise the reader. So I don't think people would think of gummy bears when they think of Germany. But that's what's great about that cover. And that cover was very commercially successful. It didn't follow any cover rules apart from the gummy bear had eye contact with the reader. I mean, that was about the only rule it did do. But I think it is very German. The story there is very German. So it just told a good story. And I think with this cover, there was so much to tell, we chose composite. Because I think sometimes one image just doesn't quite capture everything that you want to do. And yeah, there's a few little hints with the flag on the cover and the colours. But for the most part, it's just in the imagery.
Element of surprise. And one last little thing. Regular Monocle readers will know that we always have the identifier on the spine of the issue, which changes colour between each volume. And the new colour is...
Don't tell them!
Da, 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 da,
don't
da.
Tell them!
It's, well, they ought to be able to guess if they've been looking at the sort of way the colours have changed. So there's a slight theory to it. It's a bit rainbow colours. So it's gone from light green to, unsurprisingly, dark green.
Well, we all love a rainbow. Thank you very much, Rich and Poppy. To continue our chat about the Italy special edition, I'm joined by David Pleasant in the studio. In the issue, he gives us a top 10 rundown of the best Italian logos, covering everything from the Italian 90s corporate identity to Alitalia. David, welcome to the show. This was quite a fun little story to do, wasn't it? I think the whole office got involved with cutting down from quite a long list what our favourite Italian logos were. Why does Italy have this very interesting heritage and concentration on just beautiful logos?
Well, it's an interesting question, Tom. And I had, I think, obviously, before I kind of delved into writing about the specific logos, I had to think about it. And in a way, it's quite easy to answer in that there's a huge tradition of signs and, you know, the sign, the manifesto, the signage, lettering, Roman lettering is as famous as we know about. I just think it's very much inbuilt in the culture. And then if you basically look through any period of Italian history, there is this kind of tradition of signs, sign writing, visual communication, whether that's in medieval times, if you think about ancient or medieval Venice with the shop sign being very kind of dominant on the street scene, then through to kind of the Renaissance with similar signage, then right through to the industrial age with the big industries, the big companies of Italy investing in signage.
It's the sense of heraldry, isn't there? All the kind of the shields and of all the different, you know, regions of Italy over the years. I think it's sort of part to do with that, isn't it?
Exactly. So, I mean, there's that in Italian, it's called campinalismo. I think I'm getting it right. So it's that kind of rivalry between towns. And the heraldry, the shields, the uniforms, the pageants, all of that. And I think that's really infected the way logos are in Italy.
Yeah. A sense of that sort of kind of macho pride as well of, you know, what you do so proud about it, you have to sort of have a big logo or whatever to sort of sum it up and represent it to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think it's about that visual expression. You know, I think Italian culture always finds money to invest in aesthetics, you know, and people, it's sometimes quite surprising, you know, with the economic situation that has been plaguing Italy for the last few decades, it's always quite surprising how neat and smart the towns look. You know, I think there is that investment in the visual.
So let's run through a few of our favourites. I mean, these aren't ranked in any way, but it just so happens that number one is all the brand identity for Italia 90, the World Cup. And I think it's very deserving of the number one spot. It's absolutely incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, I think it just kind of sums up a period. So 1990, obviously the World Cup would have been awarded to Italy some years before that, during the course of the 1980s. And there's something of that kind of postmodern, quite optimistic, industrial kind of feeling about it, but very much based on the tricolour, the three colours, the green, white and red. And then, of course, there's the actual logo, the mascot for the World Cup. And he's a kind of fun chap called Ciao. And we should describe, he's basically a stick man made out of the Italian tricolour with a football as a head.
Sort of Lego man almost, isn't he? He's sort of got the sticks for all his joints and limbs.
Yeah, and he's quite dynamic. You know, he looks like he's just about to kick the ball, hopefully not his head, which is also a ball. But
And interestingly, this was, I mean, they didn't choose a sort of an animal mascot, did they? So it's quite a sort of step apart from the normal World Cup genre.
Exactly. A lot of World Cup mascots, as you say, are kind of cutesy and soft and have that kind of soft toy element of it. This one is very different to that. It's more kinetic, dynamic. It's got a whole different feeling, and I think that's why we chose it to go on the page.
Signore e signori, vi invitiamo a seguire con attenzione questo video sulle procedure e le dotazioni di sicurezza di questo aereo. Ladies and gentlemen, we kindly ask you to pay attention to the following presentation concerning safety procedures and equipment of this aircraft.
And keeping with these the tricolour colours of the Italian flag, Alitalia is made onto the list, which, despite its woes, is never really put a foot wrong with its CI, has it?
I don't think so. And I think it's somewhat of a shame, really, that the company hasn't really managed to live up to the expectations that, this kind of wonderful 60s design embodies, really. So we should mention that this was an international competition from 1969, and it was won by the great American graphic designer Walter Landor. I mean, this is kind of the last, perhaps, remaining typeface of that tradition of air travel from that period.
Because he also did the British Airways, the old sort of 80s and 90s logo, which I'm a massive fan of as well.
Exactly. And just to describe that, the A is kind of like a tail fin shape. So that's really easily replicable. You can put it just about everywhere all over the corporate identity of Alitalia.
And that green as well. It's a very, very lovely green.
It is a nice bright green. I think we agreed on this. It has been italicized slightly since. So it's not quite as bold as it once was. But nonetheless, it is still a striking feature of travel in and out of Italy. I think it's something that people immediately associate with the country.
And I think still all the stuff you get in the airplane, all the sort of cups and the, you know, napkins and stuff, they still do a very good job of it, I think.
I know, it's the kind of stuff that you kind of want to keep. You don't mind if you find that
totally,
those little napkins in your bag after you've been on an Alitalia flight. So I think it's that all that sums up the fact that it's really a successful logo.
Alitalia vi ringrazia per l'attenzione e si augura che il volo sia di vostro gradimento. Alitalia thanks you for your attention and hopes you will enjoy the flight.
And zooping to the bottom of the list, Ajip at number 10.
That's right.
Ajip, which is quite sort of world famous logo, isn't it? But just describe it for us, if you could.
Yeah, Ajip is the until recently, it was the kind of forecourt retail petrol brand of Eni, the Italian oil and gas giant. This also came about through a kind of very concerted effort to reorganize the company's identity, which was based on the six-legged dog, which is really extraordinary. It's a six-legged dog that's breathing fire. The six legs represent the two legs of the passenger, of the motorist, and the four legs or four wheels of the car itself. And it's just kind of trying to represent the whole, the services that the company offers. And it's got this wonderful Ajip, the actual letterhead. They devise this kind of line running through the middle of the font, which gives it a really kind of car motoring feel, I think.
Yeah, it's very, and there's something about that dog which is so sort of Romulus and Remus. It's very much working in kind of Roman tradition, yet still feels slightly kind of, you know, 1960s, 70s or whatever.
That's right.
It's got a real charm to it. And we had, as I said earlier, we had a sort of bit of trouble culling down to 10, but talk me through, and you're a big geek on this, but talk me through some of the others that didn't make the list.
Well, I think it was quite hard to discern between logos and what are just fantastic typefaces. And Italy just stands out as somewhere that has these wonderful typefaces. Things like Baci, the chocolates with the wonderful cursive font. The list is really quite endless. There's other ones, other big, you know, food and drink companies that are just known throughout the world. You know, Lavazza coffee, just these kind of wonderful, bold statements. But we did try and kind of go for the more logo-based, the ones that really are somewhat more exceptional. But yeah, it is somewhere that's just filled with wonderful examples of logos and typefaces, I think. So it was quite a hard challenge.
David Pleasant, thank you very much for joining us. And you can read all about it in our top 10 Italian logos in the March issue of Monocle magazine. Coming up next, we meet Nilla Sorensen, the award-winning Hong Kong-based architect.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Well, Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Salone del Mobile is just over a month away, and designers big and small are sprucing up their new lines ready for the scrum in April. One such exhibitor is bringing a touch of Asia to proceedings. Neela Sorensen is an award-winning architect and currently the curator of the Hong Kong Design Centre's Constant Change exhibition. Despite his Danish roots, Neela has worked in Hong Kong for over a decade and, as he told Aled John, hopes to create an exhibition that reflects new talent, old traditions and designed life in Hong Kong.
I've been so lucky. I was asked by the Hong Kong people if I could curate the Hong Kong Initiative for the Milan, and I thought that was a challenge and said yes, because I had a few ideas. I think, you know, when you go to Milan, that there's a lot of things exhibited there. It's almost too much, it's too big. And what would the approach be to find out, to make an exhibition that you maybe would remember when you left Milan? So that's what we've done, hopefully.
It certainly is a place where there's a lot on offer, and you have to spend some time, some serious time, trying to sift through a lot of it to find the stuff which you really value. What were the challenges for you, Neela?
The challenges was that if we were coming with objects, we would just look like everybody else. And I think, you know, the big manufacturers, the big producers, they come in with a heavy loaded with money, and, you know, they will bling us out. So how could we actually do something that will people remember? So the idea was that I was talking about that we needed the legacy, because, you know, for a small place like Hong Kong to burn out that sort of money and then it's gone by Friday, how could we keep the legacy? So the idea was to export the feel and the sound and the noise of Hong Kong to Milan, and at the same time, through an app and through a website, have the content and the legacy of Hong Kong. So the idea is when you actually finish with the exhibition, you have an app on your smartphone, so you can connect to the Hong Kong design scene when you come home from Milan, but also when you arrive a year later in Hong Kong. Your app will tell you that, by the way, there's a new exhibition here, there's a new thing going on here, things are opened, and the content will be slowly, there'll be more and more designers in the webpage, so you can always feel that you're in touch with Hong Kong. So that was sort of the basic idea for this.
Okay, so there's a kind of involvement for the audience as well. The exhibition title is Hong Kong, Constant Change. You talked a little bit there about the kind of elements you'd like to bring into the exhibition so people can take away a bit of Hong Kong with them. Could you, in fact, go through those elements, how you're trying to sort of give over that idea of Hong Kong, even when they're in Milan?
So what we'll do is we will not exhibit any objects. So the idea is that you come into a street, and that street is Hong Kong. So we made a film that's running on the screens, which are 4 meters tall and 13 meters. So you have the two facade, which is screens. That means you will have all the colors, all the hectic life of Hong Kong. You will have a special music who's written to it with a beat that will make your stomach shake a little bit. Because, I mean, Hong Kong is smack in your face, and especially for a guy from me who comes from quiet Copenhagen, where everything is designed and controlled. Hong Kong is just, you know, pluralism, it's action and it's energy. So we kept that in the movies, running on the two sides. Then we have benches, we have tarmac from Hong Kong, you know, with signs, street signs on. So you're basically in a Hong Kong street, and then they'll be floating around QR codes. So if you see a QR code who's linked to the story, then you just QR code it, and then you'll have an interview with the designer. You'll see what kind of designs is there. So it's a very interactive thing. And the reason for that is that we know that people will probably be there just for 20 minutes or less. So how do they remember Hong Kong? And the idea is if they download the app, maybe they just see the film and get the inspiration. When they come back to the hotel, then they can log onto the app and get, you know, all the nice interviews with the designers, or when they actually come to their hometown. So the idea is it's very sort of, it's just on screens. There'll be a little, you know, entrance area, and there'll be an exit area, but the most of it will be the screens where you actually get the feel. The only thing we need, and I struggle with that, is the smell of Hong Kong. You know, how do we get the smell? So I asked them, could we have a street kitchen? And when they heard about it in Milan, they said, no, you cannot have a street kitchen in the nice museum. So I don't know how to deal with that yet.
a tricky obstacle to climb.
It is, yeah. But I thought, you know, why couldn't we just have a guy standing there doing some noodle pots and whatever? But that's not there. So maybe we can get some perfume or whatever.
Yeah, maybe something to change the temperature as well, some humidity perhaps.
Yes, you know, we can sort that out. But I think the whole idea is that we transport the feel of Hong Kong, and that's why Constant Change is the title, because I come to Hong Kong over the last 10 years, twice a year at least. And to me, the inspiring thing is that, you know, things are changing constantly. In Denmark, I'm used to that buildings will stay there for hundreds of years. When I go to London, I know my way in and out because things are as they were the last time I was there. Here, you're shocked by the change. You know, shops are changed, buildings are changed, they're building new things, the scene is changing. Mm. And the really cool thing is that they have a young talent mass pool of really creative people who are now evolving into the society with different designs. So, I mean, in Denmark, we always said that, you know, Asia, that's just copycat. But that's not true. That, you know, they have some really young, talented people here. And what amazed me about Hong Kong is that they, for 10 years, they've been running slowly, you know, with an idea of getting design into society. So they have really good schools with fantastic professors, you know. So they set the thing up. And I think compared to other Asian city who just want to buy design and they think they can sort of, you know, take the big jump from where they are into being the hip city of design, Hong Kong have had a different sort of way of doing it by doing it slowly. And I think that that's correct. And now I think, you know, the young designers are coming through, and I'm really, you know, looking forward to present these young people in Milan, because I think they have something we could learn from in Europe.
So looking at the nuts and bolts of your exhibition then, Constant Change is the title. How many designers are you involving? And you said there was a film, so is there, have you commissioned a director? Is that element a designer in itself?
No, that's me.
That's
and,
you?
And the okay. team. Yeah, that's me and the team here in Hong Kong. So for the next 3 days, we'll be cutting the movie. We've done a test movie and everything, so they know how to film it. The designers that will be in place, about 20 designers. When you go to the webpage, then there will be a lot more to offer. But we've chosen to have 20 designers on display. And it's not just the design, it's actually the designer or the design office, because I think there's a lot of time where you get famous for doing a piece. And then they box you, so say, oh, you're furniture designer, you're industrial designer. And what I can see, the young people here, they're floating, you know, they're doing graphic design, they're working with technology, they're doing service design. And so instead of boxing them, we will just have, you know, the designers and their office presented there.
Nila, how refreshing is it for you, someone who comes from that Danish pedigree, like you say, you're currently the CEO of the Danish Design Center in Copenhagen. What's it like making that jump from Scandinavia to the Far East, to Hong Kong?
I'm very inspired by it. I love Hong Kong. You know, I think you either love Hong Kong or you run away very fast. And to me, you know, coming from this, you can say, educated society of design, is getting a little bit bored. And the thing we're struggling with in Denmark is that design is a chair or a white coffee cup. And I think it's really freed me up to come here to meet young designers and meet the whole design team of the Hong Kong Design Center. Mm. And, you know, when you pushed ideas and said, can we do this? There was never a no. They would say, okay, we'll look into it. Of course, there were some cultural barriers that they helped me with, you know, nicely sending me emails that, you know, could we do it this way or that way? But I think for me, it's also a learning process to see design in a new light, that design is not a chair. You know, maybe we should start concentrating about answering the bigger challenges in the world. And I see the young people here, they have moved from a me generation to a we. And that's what I feel really inspired by.
It's a very interesting idea, that the idea that design, it depending on which country you're in, could be a chair, a cup, a table. Or if you go to somewhere like South Africa, for instance, or maybe Hong Kong, Cape Town just won the World Design Capital, and their celebration of it is to change up the urban design of a post-apartheid city. And so the difference for them, as compared to, say, Helsinki, that had it within the last few years, Helsinki was very much about the cups and the chairs, and this is what design in Scandinavia is. But depending on the place you go to, the design could be big, broad and bold changes afoot.
Yeah, and I think if you look at Cape Town, if you look at a lot of places, and even if you look at Scandinavia, to be honest, we need to move designers into the sphere that I call system design, because, you know, we can design gadget. Everybody can design a new mobile phone. But I think, you know, creative people, cool in designers, architects, you know, astrophysics, if they come together with engineers and start designing the systems that we have to work with for the next, like, 10 years, then someone else can design the gadget. And I think that's where designers should start looking at it. It's the system design, which is crucial for everything in the future. And we can see that how all the technology we have, they'll probably invent everything. But will it speak to each other? Can we actually, as human being, control it? So there's all these things where I think some of the creative people, they have to look into the system. And when we have the system working, and by the way, in Denmark, we're really good at doing that, you know, then someone else can design the gadget, because the gadget will probably just live for, what, 9 months, 6 months, because, you know, we are living in an exponential world, so things will change dramatically. And I can see that, you know, both in South Africa, in Hong Kong here, and in Denmark, there is a sort of a trend moving slowly towards this system design. And I know from talks with IKEA, you know, how can we close the gap between waste and new material? So waste will be a new material. And it's not the suits who will do this for us. It's the creative people who have to come together and find a solution. When we then have the solution, then we'll have a new industry. The industry will move back to our cities, and we will have a totally different fabric. And again, it has to be the architects, designers, and creative people who will create the new cities for us. So that's my dream. I hope I get there before I die.
Nila Sorensen speaking to Aled John. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. We pay a quick visit to the designer's studio in Melbourne now. This week, we stop off in the old industrial neighbourhood of East Brunswick, where we have been welcomed into the home of the eccentric lighting designer Volker Haug. Sealed away in his rather large and decidedly luminous studio, Volker invited us in to talk about his inspiration, legacy and the future of the light globe.
I'm originally from Germany. I've moved to Australia in 2000, so nearly 14 years ago, and I was a hairdresser for 19 years of my life. And about 7 years ago, I started my own business as a lighting designer. I had a thing for lighting all my life and was finally made the jump and met an amazing lighting designer who I worked with for a year and a half. And through him, I did kind of like a fast track apprenticeship, mentorship. So it was a very quirky lighting designer called Jeffrey Mans. And there's been quite a few of us who work with him. And there's quite a few of us, again, who have started their own lighting business through him. So quite a bit of offspring there. He was a very inventive, crazy artist who did a lot of lighting with natural materials, sticks, and like, beautiful sculptures out of that. And we all worked there with him, helping him to run the business. He got sick quite quickly and died quite quickly then as well, and there wasn't much time to organize and plan many things, and he maybe wasn't the most organized person in the world. But the people who could really run his lighting business were the people who were actually working there, because anyone else, family or something, would have been very difficult. So he ended up giving the business to two of the people who worked there. One of them is my friend Chris Boots, who has also got his own lighting studio now. And another guy, Dean, who actually still runs this company. So the sort of lighting I do is I'm quite fascinated by repetitive patterns. There's a lot of patterns in my work. I'm also quite like color. So there's a lot of colorful things here as well. We use a lot of different materials to make lights out of. Probably the craziest one is we use secondhand light shades that we crush with a forklift and 2.5 tons of steel scraps. Then we get them anodized and then we bolt them together into a big light fitting that's 1.7 meters in diameter. And that's made out of 19 of those individual once upon a time light shades. Pretty crazy. We're doing a GP doctor's practice, which is quite fun. So it's a practice and that person in particular wants to have something that's not your normal average kind of doctor's practice. So I think I might even convert and go to her after that as well. She quite likes lights with red cables, and she sort of, her take is that those are the arteries of the body, which is quite cool. So I think it's about 360 square meters that we have here, and we have an upstairs and a downstairs, so it's great to be able to have a separate studio where we make everything, and then have a beautiful showroom with the office at the end upstairs. And prior to that, we've had a great studio at the convent in Abbotsford, but it was all under the one roof, so if someone would be drilling and there would be phone call coming in, it was quite difficult at times. I'm quite a big fan of Nicolas Jaar, the DJ, and there's one song that makes me very happy every time I listen to it, and it is called Stay in Love by Wolf and Lamb Recordings. Government regulations becoming more and more strict, that they pretty much banning all the fancy, beautiful incandescent filament light globes that we designers use for in many of our designs, especially us. We use, our designs are very minimalist, and we often have the light globe exposed, which is quite an important factor in the design. And if you're only stuck with compact fluorescents or LEDs, that is a bit sad. There are some great LEDs out there that are really quite amazing, however it's still not the same than using an incandescent globe, so I've went crazy and bought up a whole, everything that was left in the country, and my garage is now like a big lighting warehouse. But I have already seen some great things since that has happened. For example, LED light globes that look like the filament light globes, where actually instead of the LED dots having like actual small filaments, but it actually is LED, so I think we need to work on it a little bit more, but it'll get there. So eventually, hopefully, it can be replaced like for like.
Volker Haug giving us a tour of his studio space there. Coming up, we hear from the winner of Canada's Emerging Designer Award at this year's Design Exchange. We also speak to iconic British graphic designer Anthony Burrell.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Last week, Canada's Design Exchange celebrated the best of the country's young talent and announced this year's winner of the Emerging Designer Competition. He is 26-year-old Lucas Peet. When he was 18, the Calgary-born designer left for the Netherlands to study at Design Academy Eindhoven. He settled in Vancouver after graduation, but his European experience remains apparent in his works, which ranges from graphic design to furniture to lighting. They all share a clean, minimal aesthetic and elegant fluid lines. Monocle's Jason Lee caught up with Lucas, who says that design has been a part of his life since he was a child, thanks to his jewellery designer father.
For me, I think it came very early because my father's a jewellery designer. So I grew up basically in an environment that was completely creative and had a lot of opportunities to do anything. After elementary school, for instance, we would go make things until he was done working. So some of the first objects I ever made were actually in silver and gold. Throughout, you know, high school and all that, yeah, everything was possible and just made lots of things together. And
talking about making things, you've dabbled in a lot of things, from lighting to furniture to even graphic design. Which of these mediums is your favorite and why?
I don't like to limit myself, but I think products are more interesting to me on their scale and also the availability to the potential user. I'm currently doing a retail space, for instance. I think if you're able to produce a product on a larger scale, a larger number, and reach a wider audience, then I think that's a bit more interesting to me. But yeah, like you said, I like whole aspects of creativity, I guess.
You studied in the Netherlands at the Design Academy Eindhoven. the influences, I think, are quite apparent in your work. So my question to you is, what's so Canadian about your designs?
I wouldn't say there's anything typically Canadian about my designs. Both my parents are Dutch, so I grew up in a European family. And the way I sort of see it is I left Canada when I was 18 to go to Design Academy Eindhoven. And it was my time there that showed me what's possible with design and different scales or different creative opportunities.
Can you describe a little bit about your design philosophy and how you've evolved as a designer over the past few years?
Yeah, for me, it needs to have something different, either on like a unexpected scale, unexpected material, color, function. If you have the opportunity to create something new, you should try to.
After graduation in the Netherlands, was it a difficult decision to decide to move back to Canada?
It wasn't difficult where I wanted to live, but I did realize it would maybe be difficult to be successful or to do the kind of things I wanted to do. I moved back at a very young age, and I'd never actually lived in Canada as an adult on my own because I left for Eindhoven quite early. And it was frustrating in the beginning, but I think I'm in a good spot now, and you know, obviously getting recognition with the award is great. I've met a really good supportive community of creative people, and I think that something is starting to grow, or there's definitely some interesting things happening.
Where do you think the Canadian design scene is moving towards?
I think the Canadian design scene is moving in a lot of different directions, and I say that because I think Canada being such a young country and such a large country that you have such diversity between all the cities and all the provinces, I think it's this diversity and this young age of the country that it's so fresh and so blank, I guess, on that side of things that it has no baggage, I guess.
This is the Emerging Designer Competition. If you could have the career of any designer in the world, who would that be and why?
That's a difficult question. I think it would be many different ones. Again, my father, because he's definitely passionate about it and he just loves doing it. And Aldo Bakker, one of my teachers in Design Academy, he also makes very unexpected work, I'd say. Very interesting forms and functions. Tom Dixon is very interesting in how he produces his work and the amount of interesting work he makes. Konstantin Gerchik is very interesting in his manufacturing techniques and his process. So basically, I guess to sum up, those are all designers I would say are very passionate and just enjoy what they do and push themselves more than worry about what everyone else is doing.
Canada's Emerging Designer winner, Lucas Peet, in conversation with Jason Lee. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. The British graphic designer Anthony Burrell made his name with prints that combine big, bold wording with simple colour contrasts. Poster prints that exclaim phrases like, I like it, what is it? Or work hard and be nice to people afforded Burrell a loyal following who found a truth and approachability in his works. He's just released a book of 30 posters of them, and he came in to tell Ale John all about it.
I like it's just the spirit of that question, really, that phrase. You know, it's just saying, you know, I like it, but I'm not sure what it is yet, but I still like it. You know, it's kind of, I go a lot on kind of intuition and, you know, kind of just having a feel for things, really. So, yeah, and I like questions.
So the collection is looking at, well, it's a good example of your style, I guess, to an extent.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you could, let's look through some of these designs. It's a very beautifully put together book. Yeah, with some great photos as well as some great prints in there from your career.
Yeah, it's it was designed by designers called A Practice for Everyday Life, who I've known for quite a while, Emma Thomas and Kirsty Carter. I've worked with them on a couple of projects before, but they brought a whole different kind of feel to the way that the book was put together.
And this typifies your style to an extent, kind of striking a lot of it print. Poster prints sort of style.
Yeah, the idea of the book that it is it's a collection of posters, I think 30 posters. So, and you can kind of pull them out of the book, you can pull the book apart. But yeah, it's kind of some of the projects, like the oldest one is back from 96. So yeah, back in the day of photocopies and using glue and scalpels to make the work.
Do you see that kind of harkens back to an era which is less used now or less common in the sort of field that you work in?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I didn't have a choice in those days because I couldn't afford a computer because they were far too expensive. It was the way I worked, you know, it was all photocopies and stuck down things. It was all very direct and simple.
If we could, perhaps it'd be best if you could describe what it is we're looking at the moment. So this is, I love this one, the back of which it explains it, but the front is, this was an advertising campaign for a Dutch hotel.
Yeah, that's
through
right.
Through an ad company. Now even more noise, you've got two prints of airplanes flying over the top. It's kind of reaffirming the budgetary nature of the hotel.
Yeah, well, that's for the Hans Brinker budget hotel. It's kind of infamous for being the worst hotel in the world. So that was a campaign with Eric Kessels, Kessels Kramer, fantastic
design advertising agency.
Yeah. So that was, that was one of the kind of earliest. I suppose it was the campaign that kind of put me on the map a bit, really. But yeah, that was all done with photocopies and sticking down every individual letter. So yeah, it was about the hotel being horrible. But yeah, it was good.
Something fun to work on.
Yeah, definitely.
What is it about this technique? It develops as we go along, but if anything, it becomes more dedicated to words and typography than it does at the start. What is it about this sort of simplistic, slightly austere, but very striking nature of your work?
I think I'm always...
That appeals to you.
Yeah, I'm always looking for the essence of what it's about, really. So kind of stripping the kind of visual aspects back as much as possible. And yeah, there's a progression through the book, even though there's a kind of thread that runs through it. There's definitely a progression where it gets less imagery and more to do with text, really. So yeah, I'm just interested in telling stories in the simplest way possible.
So that's a very interesting idea. So why every artist or designer, I guess, wants to tell a story to an extent.
Yeah.
As simple as they are, there's many little facets of each one which are intriguing. Why the font, for instance, on the work hard and be nice to people? That's one of the most famous ones of your prints.
Yeah, that's my hit.
Yeah, the money spinner.
Yeah.
Why the font, why the design, why the layout, why work hard in big, bold, smaller and be nice to people?
Well, this poster came out of a collaboration with a woodblock letterpress printers down in Rye, where I live, Adams of Rye. So I'd moved out of London and living in a very, very small village in Kent. And there's this fantastic printers, letterpress and woodblock. It was kind of a graphic designer's dream, really. So this is about, it's actually 10 years ago since I first made this poster. It was just a statement I kind of wanted to make, really. The whole thing happened by chance. It was very, happened very naturally. But yeah, the kind of choice of typography, that was informed by the way it was made using letterpress. And I kind of worked with the printer there and I said, make the first two lines big and the second two a bit smaller. And that was the kind of instructions I gave him, really.
And the message, does it chime perhaps with your intention to leave London at the time?
Well, yeah, it's kind of my whole life philosophy, really.
Work hard, be nice to people.
It genuinely is. I think it's got that kind of, in a similar way to the title of the book, it's got a similar kind of that wide-eyed, optimistic, everything's going to be okay kind of feel about it.
There's a sense of simplicity, not just to the designs, but also to the narrative that you're choosing.
Yeah, yeah.
You get partnered up with some very interesting people, though. Alain de Botton is one. Mm. He's been on the radio here before. He sees a sort of innate truth to your work as well. What's it like working with someone like him? Does he choose the copy? Do you give him the phrases? Or is it like, let's combine our simple but kind of positive outlook?
Yeah, I think that, again, that the work with Alain came through a project called Graphic Design And. So they were teaming up designers with, non-designers. And Alain and I communicated via email, just kind of talked about a few simple ideas. You know, for me, it was kind of quite daunting, because he's...
contemporary philosopher.
Yeah. But then it was like, he's such a... He's such a lovely person to work with, it's very, again, it felt very natural. I think that when I work collaboratively a lot and when it works best, the collaborations feel very natural and almost, you don't have to think about them too much.
Looking towards the more current work that's in this collection, we say yes towards the end. Where do you see your work heading towards? It's still very focused on text.
Yeah.
But the colours are a little bit broader, a bit brasher perhaps.
Mm.
Are you heading into a different kind of style or are you content in what you're doing at the moment?
I think always the thing for me is the message working? Is it kind of, is it working properly? And I think, I've got a kind of visual language that I kind of stick to a lot. But then I'm also kind of with various collaborations, kind of working on kind of in different disciplines, really. So kind of moving image and interiors, and, you know, there's no end of possibility for kind of things I want to get involved in.
That was Anthony Burrell there talking to our very own Aled John. That brings us to the end of today's show. It was produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Aled at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and playing you out today in honour of our Italy special is Giorgia with Ecce Ancora Mare. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.